This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. Chances are good that somewhere not far from you, maybe in your own neighborhood, there's a toddler who's struggling. He or she was born with a congenital defect. Maybe he's showing signs of brain function problems. Maybe she has a physical challenge that makes it difficult for her to even ingest enough food to thrive. If you knew this child, if you knew the family, what kind of help would you want them to get? There are government programs available, medical therapies that would make a tremendous difference, but with budgets stretched tight, those services are far from fully funded. What should be done? This hour we talk with counselors, child health advocates, and parents about their view. But if you have an opinion, we're hoping to hear from you too, as we examine the benefits and costs of early childhood medical interventions right after the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. The federal government says early childhood intervention service programs providing critical medical treatment to infants and toddlers must be fully funded. But Virginia has not had enough money to pay for its share of those services. What should be done? Today, we examine that question closely with a look at just what these early childhood treatments are, who needs them, why they are needed, and how such treatments have made a huge difference in quality of life for some specific children in our region. People with a variety of experience have agreed to help out, but if at any point you have an opinion to offer, a story to share, a question to ask, you are invited to join us here at 888-WMRA-TALK. That's 888-967-2825. We begin with two people with different connections to this issue. Emily Griffey is a senior policy analyst at the children's advocacy group that calls itself Voices for Virginia's Children. Christine Gregory is the system manager for an early childhood treatment agency called Infant and Toddler Connection of Harrisonburg, Rockingham. Ms. Griffey, Ms. Gregory, thank you both for making time for us.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Well, Emily, from Voices for Virginia's Children, let's start with you. What do you most want people to know about early childhood intervention treatments and the state of those treatment programs in Virginia?
Great. Thank you for having us here today, Tom. I want to share with folks a little bit about early intervention services, and hopefully Chris can fill in a bit with a story about more detail on early intervention. Early intervention is services for children, infants and toddlers who are 0 to 3, who have a developmental delay or disability. These services are provided at the local level through Infant and Toddler Connection, and they are funded at the federal level through the IDA Part C. So you may have heard all of those words, early intervention, infant and toddlers, and Part C, and they mean the same thing.
And let me just double check, because I already lost track. IDA Part C, that's part of Medicaid?
No, it's part of the Department of Education, IDA services for children that have disabilities.
So it's a federally mandated program.
Yes.
To provide treatment for children who have certain kinds of medical conditions between birth and age 3.
Yes, and the IDA program also extends into special education in the schools as well.
Okay.
So this Part C actually takes place, and early intervention services take place in the home for children who are 0 to 3, infants and babies.
What kinds of children are we talking about? What kinds of conditions? What kinds of treatments?
It ranges. It's any child that's delayed 25% or more, so behind their peers about 3 months. And that could be a speech condition, that could be a motor physical condition, not walking or crawling on time. That could be a birth defect that would cause some more serious motor and physical conditions in the long term, but it's really a range of issues. We've had infant toddler services since the 80s, and just within the last 5 years, Virginia has seen a great increase in services. We've had a 52% increase in infants and toddlers who are identified for services, which means now that over 15,000 infants and toddlers are served in 1 year. That increase has created a shortfall in the state funding for the services, where we're now at an $8.5 million shortfall for those services because of that increase. And it's a really good thing that we're finding more infants and toddlers to be served through the program, because that means that they're getting help early on, and this is the help and intervention that can help them perform better in school and be able to learn and thrive throughout their lifetime.
Let me go to Chris Gregory for a moment.
Because it's
my understanding that this is very personal for you.
It is.
That 8 years ago, when you were an elementary school teacher in Rockingham County, you gave birth to a daughter who was almost 3 months premature.
I did.
And she was less than 2 pounds when she was born?
She was.
Her name's Anissa?
My daughter is named Anissa. And she spent 54 days in the hospital at UVA after she was born. So she was 1 pound, 15 ounces. And if you can picture it, she fit in the palm of your hand. That's how small she was when she was born.
So the kinds of treatments that we're going to talk about this hour, the kinds of services that the federal government says must be available to children under the age of 3, your daughter would have been included in having services available to her, special treatments for a child whose development is going to be so stunted if they're born that much premature. But you didn't know that this service was available.
I didn't know. No, and she had feeding issues when she was born. So
what does that mean, feeding
issues? She had trouble sucking on the bottle to get enough to drink enough on her own. So we had to supplement it with a feeding tube down her throat when she couldn't finish her bottle. And she just didn't have the muscle control in her mouth to be able to suck and get the formula out of the bottle. And so when she went home, she'd only been off the feeding tube one day. And I wasn't given any kind of instruction on how to get her to feed. It was just told she needs to drink every feeding every time. So we had a lot of times where she wouldn't eat an entire bottle, and she'd get tired from feeding. I'd get stressed. We made many trips back and forth to the doctor to have weight checks. And had I known that these services were out there, a speech therapist could have been helping me with exercises on how to increase the muscle control and increase her ability to feed on her own.
So if you had known about the treatments that were available, if you had known about these federal programs that mandate that you and your child have access to this service, what would have happened for your daughter that didn't happen at the time?
She probably would have grown faster. She came home from the hospital at 4 pounds and 5 ounces, little teeny tiny still. But even at the age of 1 year, where most 12-month-olds are between 20 and 30 pounds, she was at about 15. So
what would have been done that would have resulted in her growing faster?
She would have had the muscle control to chew and swallow and do all those things that she needed to have the nutrition and the support.
So there were some kind of therapies that would have been done.
Yes.
Do you know what those are?
Well, there's a lot of different things you can do with the mouth. Some brushing, toothbrushes in the mouth for babies, even when they don't have teeth yet, to stimulate in the mouth. You can do some outside of the mouth exercises, getting them to play tug of war with a washcloth in the bathtub or after a feeding are all ways to just kind of strengthen those oral motor muscles in the mouth and make eating easier.
So physical therapists or therapists who in some way would help Anissa's 6 month or 8 month or 10 month old muscles develop, so that she could eat properly and she could grow at a normal rate. Those therapists actually would have come into your home to work with your baby.
Yes, they would have. They would come in and show me the techniques of what to do every mealtime or before every mealtime so that I could carry those out while they weren't there.
I understand, Emily Griffey, that the most common type of treatments, of therapists who come into a home to help a child in need, are usually called physical therapy, speech therapy, and believe it or not, occupational therapy. And yet, my guess is when you're working with a baby that's 4 or 8 or 12 weeks old, those terms may not mean what we usually think they mean.
Right. Well, learning is their occupation at that age. So they need to be get their brain working and the cognitive function so that all of the brain development that happens in those earliest years can happen properly. We know that 85% of the brain develops before a child is 5. And so that is what makes these services really critical. As the hardwiring and muscle memory is happening at these ages, these are the moments that will lead to further success down the road. And that's actually a little bit about why Voices is involved in this issue of early intervention. I focus on early care and education for Voices, which is a variety of issues for children who are 0 through 5 and coming to school and needing to be prepared for school, which include kindergarten, pre-kindergarten, childcare, home visiting programs like CHIP and Healthy Families. And early intervention is one of those critical services in that continuum as well, so that any kid can catch up to their peers and can start school ready to learn. Voices takes the framework that policies that can really help, that are proven to help children and have researched successful outcomes, are the highest level priorities for investment. And so we look at the research and which programs have successful track records and prioritize those for our advocacy and for investment in children and early education. One example that we did is bring together all of those early childhood advocates from the childcare arena, teachers, pediatricians, home visiting programs, and we bring them together to develop a unified agenda for our advocacy and see which issues rise to the top. And this year, funding for services with a critical need, like early intervention, rose to the top of our priorities. So that's why we're involved in this issue and why we are hoping to get the message out around that we need to fill in this shortfall for early intervention services so that Anissas of the world and others who have received these services can succeed in school. Many can graduate and complete these services and not receive any additional special education after they've participated in early intervention. And so we just want to let every kid have the chance to have that opportunity.
Emily Griffey from Voices for Virginia's Children and Chris Gregory from the Infant and Toddler Connection of Harrisonburg-Rockingham are our guests. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. If you have a question or comment, we do have a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. Chris, by the way, how is Anissa today? She's 8 years old?
She's 8 years old. She's in third grade, and she's a straight-A student.
And from what I've heard, you would never know that this child was born almost three months premature? What is it that you want people to know about cost effectiveness? It seems to me I've heard an argument from some people in your field that even though in Virginia right now this program is significantly underfunded, the fact of the matter is if children before the age of 3 could get these treatments, it would end up costing the taxpayer less later in the child's life?
It will.
Make that argument for me.
Many infants and toddlers that come into our program graduate before they get to age 3. About 20% of them, if they get the adequate services that they need no additional early childhood special ed services once they reach school age.
So when you say graduate from this program before the age of 3, they've gotten enough better that they now have the function and the health aspects of a non-challenged child.
And their families feel like they have the resources and the skills and the abilities to help them reach those milestones as they continue to develop and grow.
Okay, so I have to ask you for more of the answer about cost effectiveness because, as you can hear from the music, we have to pause for the break. We also, I understand, have on the phone line with us a parent who's had a close-up and personal experience with the early childhood treatment programs of Virginia. We'll hear from her in just a bit more than 1 minute. early childhood medical interventions, our focus this hour. Chris Gregory serves as local system manager for the Harrisonburg-Rockingham division of an early childhood treatment agency called Infant and Toddler Connection. Emily Griffey serves as senior policy analyst for the advocacy group Voices for Virginia's Children. This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. And before we get to that parent I was promising we'd get to, we have a question from Lori in Charlottesville. So, Lori, we jumped you to the head of the line. Please go ahead.
Hi, I'd like to speak about the budget shortfall and what sorts of plans are in place to close that gap. My daughter, Ava, was diagnosed with a congenital heart defect shortly after birth, tetralogy of Fallot with pulmonary atresia. I had her evaluated by the Infant Toddler Connection of the Blue Ridge when she was about 8 months old, about 10 weeks after her second open heart surgery. She was identified as being delayed and needing services, but to date has not been able to receive services. She's 18 months old now, and I just spoke with someone there a few days ago, and we decided to remove her from the waiting list at this point because she's caught up in some areas, and now we're just hoping that we'll be able to get services through the public school system once she turns three. So I'd just like to know about plans to close that budget shortfall.
This looks like a question for you, Emily.
Yes. Lori, I'm sorry to hear that Ava has been put on the waiting list and has been not able to receive services because the budget shortfall came into place, was identified about a year ago, February. There are several local agencies, and where Chris works in Harrisonburg is one of them, that have had to significantly cut back on their services because of that shortfall and sort of ask families to wait. We don't want any child that's 0 to 3 to have to wait for these services. As we've talked about, that those critical years of growth and development are key to over a lifetime of services. What the General Assembly is considering right now is the opportunity to fill in that budget shortfall so that services for this coming year can be more full and services for the next budget year, which starts in fiscal year 14, can be fully funded. We are thankful for the governor's support, who has included $3 million in his budget for this current year that we're in and the next fiscal year. And we are asking anyone who has a legislator, which is all of you, to contact legislators and let them know that you support filling in that additional funding for early intervention services, which would be $5.5 million for the next year. We have been encouraging folks like you who are hoping to get services and other families who have been successful in seeing how early intervention has positive benefits to share their stories with their legislators and encourage them to hear from their constituents that this is a priority for investment for the state.
Lori, I've heard some advocates on this issue say that since the federal government requires these treatments to be available for young children, that a wait list like what you had to be on for early intervention services is similar to a wait list to attend public schools. Is that a kind of analogy that you feel fits your situation?
Yeah, you know, I think it was disheartening for me to get the confirmation that she was delayed, but then in the next breath to say, but you've got to wait, and not know when she would be able to receive help. The challenge, I understand the struggle of asking, you know, the federal government to pay for this. The struggle then becomes who pays for the help further down the road when they don't catch up. You know, thankfully Ava has caught up for the most part to her peers. She walked late. She talked late, you know, we're still working on her speech, but she will need more open heart surgeries down the road, and there is new data coming out of the Children's Hospital of Philadelphia that children with congenital heart defects continue to have neurological issues further down the road. And so this is something that needs to be jumped on early while these babies are still in the hospital, and that they go home with that help, not have to search it out. So I think, you know, mandatory, you know, interventions and therapies would do nothing but help these babies in this situation.
Lori, I think it's a clear case from what you're saying. We believe that any investment in early childhood is an investment that will pay off in the long term. And we use the phrase of it's an investment because we do expect a return on that investment, that there will be savings down the road. So I think that's one thing that helps to raise this to the top of the priorities of the state. I think the other thing is exactly what you were mentioning, that these are services that are required and mandated by the federal government. And if we don't provide them, we could be at greater risk of losing additional funding.
Lori, thank you so much for your call, and our very best wishes certainly to you and Ava. Joining us now by phone is a Waynesboro woman who's had extensive experience with early childhood intervention services. She works as a hairdresser. Her husband works in computer systems management. Together, they have two young children. The youngest, a boy named Jax, was born 2 years ago this month. And within an hour after birth, the baby was rushed to a neonatal intensive care unit where it was eventually determined that he was facing a number of medical challenges, including a brain disorder that I believe is called polymicrogyra. From Waynesboro, Brittany Forgrave, thank you for making time for us.
Thank you.
Well, Ms. Forgrave, this brain function condition that your son Jax was born with, I understand in his case, it was something that affected his ability to do most anything with his mouth, to eat, to swallow, to speak, even sometimes to breathe. Any movement of the tongue or jaw was hindered by this condition. When you first found out about this, after your child was born, it must have been terribly frightening.
It was. The actual pronunciation, don't get upset that I'm going to correct you.
But oh, please, no, I was hoping somebody would.
It is actually called polymicrogyra. His is luckily located are just around his sylvian fissures. Most cases, it is actually throughout the entire brain. But when it took UVA about 5 days to diagnose Jax with both of his very rare conditions, and we felt like our world had ended, and it was hard to be told by doctors that your child may or may not ever speak and may or may never eat and may or may never walk. At the moment, I had felt like my world had ended. But luckily, through amazing, amazing doctors and therapists through UVA Medical Center, when you have a child that is born with very rare disorders and conditions, they seek treatment very rapidly. He also had a NG tube in the beginning where that goes up your nose and down into your stomach, and was fed for the first 2 weeks that way, and then they did surgery and they installed what is called a G-tube, which is actually the way we currently feed him now. But while he was in the hospital through the 28 days he was there, he actually started receiving services like speech therapy, physical therapy, and actually occupational therapy. And I know that sounds very wild for a infant of that age to be receiving services such as those, but he was the occupational therapist for the neonatal intensive care unit at UVA, formed hand and leg and foot splints specifically designed for his little body. And the speech pathologist came in and worked with him on jaw closure and trying to swallow and trying to want to suck and even reading books to him. And then basically those services were told to me, well, through those services that he received at UVA, they told me that I would need to contact early intervention to be able to get those services at home. His other rare condition is actually called arthrogryposis, and luckily his is on the milder side. Most arthrogryposis kids cannot bend at the elbows and knees and in most of their joints, and he luckily can, but he is a very stiff child. He needs lots of physical therapy, lots of occupational therapy to learn how to use his hands and his fingers. And then speech therapy, well, that's very obvious that he needs that, because actually in the beginning stages of an infant's life, their cry, their suck, their swallow, the way they move their tongue is all preparatory to be able to speech later on in life. We don't think about that a baby's cry is important for their vocalization as they grow and they change, but all of that is helping a child be able to speak. So we, at day 28, left the hospital and got home. And when we left the hospital, he actually had a feeding tube that he left with, a pulse ox monitor, a oxygen tank, an apnea monitor, and a feeding machine that my husband and I had to learn how to use all of those. He was a child hooked up to those specific devices from about birth to 6 months, and then we started to be able to get rid of some of his machines. But it was crucial for us to start early intervention at home right when we got him home. So we started it at about when he was 2 months old, and luckily I had been trained in some occupational therapy, some stretches while he was in the NICU, and had been trained on some things to do with him orally with a pacifier and with maybe stroking his chin and, you know, rubbing my finger around his mouth. And luckily those specific items that were shown to me helped me until the therapist started coming into my home. And luckily I have one of the most amazing go-getter coordinators, I think, possible. She has made sure that I had everything I needed, and the speech therapist and the physical therapist and the occupational therapist were lined up, and we have been receiving speech therapy and physical therapy once a week, every week, and occupational therapy 1 to 2 times a month since birth.
Brittany Forgrave in Waynesboro, I understand the good news part of this story, as much as there's obviously been trauma and difficulty, is that your son, Jax, who turned 2 just a couple of weeks ago, has made amazing progress, and he recently learned to say the word mama. Did I get that right?
That's right.
You got these services through this federally mandated program where, as of the time that Jax was less than 3 months old, physical therapists, speech therapists, occupational therapists started coming into your home on a regular basis.
That is correct.
Giving treatment to your son and teaching you and your husband how to do those treatments on your own. There are families, and that's part of the reason we're having this conversation today, because this program is so underfunded, who, like a previous caller was telling us, are on a wait list, and they, because there isn't enough money, can't get this kind of service for their child. Do you have any thoughts about that?
Wow, well, my heart ached when I heard that specific caller call and tell me that her daughter had been put on that wait list. I ache for families that are on this wait list, because it's going to delay everything to have a child have to wait. I mean, my son is speaking and he is tasting food and he is trying to drink from a sippy and he is walking along the couch and he is picking up his toys because of these therapists. And I am not crying in my closet as much because of these therapists and what they've taught me and because of my coordinator and the strength and the support that I feel from my coordinator and from my therapist is unbelievable. And it kills me that there are families out there waiting to have the support that I have had for the last 2 years. There's no way that you can make it having a special needs child without that support. It is absolutely so positively crucial for a child and the parent and or caregiver to have that support system in place.
Brittany, we were originally going to let you off the phone line, and I know that you've got other things in your schedule today, but I wonder, can you stay with us for a few more minutes?
That's fine.
Okay, because we now have with us another Chris. This is Christopher Robinson from Stanton on the phone line. He and his wife, Carrie, have two young children, the youngest of which is 21-month-old Caitlin, who was born with a cleft lip and cleft palate. And Mr. Robinson, I understand that although you knew from the time of your daughter's birth that she was going to require a wide variety of specialized treatment, it was not until she was almost a year old that you found out about these early intervention treatments that were available to your family?
Yeah, that's correct, Tom. We took Caitlin to MCV in Richmond, and they didn't mention that she qualified. The cleft was an automatic qualifier for early intervention services. None of the nurses at the hospital that we took her to or her...
Where she was born.
I'm sorry?
The hospital where she was born.
Correct. The hospital she was born or MCV when we went to go see their specialist, their speech pathologist, and their plastic surgeon. And nobody mentioned until we saw a speech pathologist at UVA who said, hey, cleft lip and palate is an automatic qualifier for early intervention services.
Do I understand correctly, Mr. Robinson, that the nurses at the hospital where your daughter was born told you that they actually had to access a YouTube video in order to learn how to properly feed a baby with Caitlin's condition?
Correct. They contacted UVA, and UVA put them on a YouTube video in order to learn how to cut the bottles in a proper way that she could so she could eat. Because one of the issues with cleft palate is that because there's a hole in the roof of the mouth, the child cannot create negative pressure or suction. So the bottle, basically, the jaw has to create all the movement out of the bottle. So yeah, that's correct.
Chris Gregory with Infant and Toddler Connection. We're hearing a story very similar to yours, only many years after yours, where, again, parents, waitlist or not, don't even know that the services are available. Why is that?
Well, I think that, at least in our area, we do an awful lot of outreach to pediatricians and hospitals and doctors. And at least once a year, we're making a contact with those agencies to tell them about the different ways that kids can qualify for this program. The problem is that with the budget shortfall, it makes it really hard to concentrate on getting the word out there to these agencies so that they can provide information to parents.
The case for early childhood intervention is our focus this hour. This conversation is going to continue in just a bit more than 1 minute. Our guest this hour from the advocacy group Voices for Virginia's Children, Emily Griffey, from the Early Childhood Treatment Agency Infant and Toddler Connection of Harrisonburg, Rockingham, Chris Gregory. By phone, Waynesboro parent of a special needs child, Brittany Forgrave, and Stanton, Virginia parent of a special needs child, Christopher Robinson. Chris, tell us a little bit more about how your daughter, Caitlin, is doing now. She's now 21 months old?
Correct. She's 21 months old, and as a result of the physical therapy and speech therapy, she is walking. She's still a little behind on her speech, but she's walking. Basically, all of her gross and fine motor skills are where they need to be, and language is still a little behind, but Our speech pathologist keeps telling us that, you know, we're moving in the right direction, and we're still waiting for the day that she says mama, but I'd still love to hear dada.
Chris, these treatments that you finally accessed about the time that Caitlin turned a year old, that the federal government says should have been available to you from the time she was born. Once you started having those treatments, and I guess they've been going on for 10, 11 months now, what kinds of things did the therapist who came to your home do for Caitlin, and what did they teach you and your wife to do?
Well, I'll start with speech therapy. Basically, one of the things that they started with was working on how to feed her. Trying to feed a child with a cleft palate is a challenge. And we talked about bottles and just different feeding techniques, and encouraged us to try to use solid food. And there was just a constant ongoing conversation as to how to encourage her to eat more solid food. As far as the physical therapy, because the previous callers mentioned an NG tube, Caitlin was on an NG tube for about 9 months. And as a result, she developed a flat spot in the back of her head. So one of the things that the physical therapist did was to try and get her to learn to balance herself, because the flat spot, and she had kind of atrophied on one of her legs. And then they hooked us up with some helmet therapy in order to address the flat spot on the back of her head. But once she got to a point where she was walking and going upstairs, the physical therapy kind of went away. But speech is still there, and will continue to be.
We have this post now on our Virginia Insight Facebook page from Amanda. Amanda saying, I am an early intervention service provider and also a K-12 educator for students who are blind and vision impaired. My students who do not receive early intervention services come to school behind and tend to stay behind where we could expect them to be if they'd receive those crucial 3 years of treatment. We need to do something in Virginia. I hope this discussion helps develop some awareness so people can advocate for more funding. Chris Robinson, do you have a question either for our in-studio guests or your fellow parent there on the phone line, Brittany Forgrave?
My question is just kind of simple. To whoever, how can we prevent, how do we address the waitlisted issue, and that's obvious by speaking to your legislatures, but how do we make it so that parents born with clefting or any other automatic qualifier for these early intervention services do not fall through the cracks like my wife and I and our daughter did? What can we do?
Well, I think it's great that you are sharing your story today.
This is Emily Griffey.
Yes, and talking about how you've gotten help and how others have gotten help. I know sometimes it's hard for parents to admit that there are problems and children are not developing on time. So I think it's okay to say
question is,
you need help.
What can we do so that less people fall through the cracks, so that more people know that these services are available? And I guess it's worth pointing out that there are some places in the state, and Augusta County and Stanton and Waynesboro seem to be among them, where despite the budget shortfall, everybody who's asking for the service and the treatment is getting it currently. Some other places, like we've heard in Charlottesville, there's a waiting list. But if you're even in a place that doesn't currently have a waiting list and you don't know that these treatments are available for a child who needs them, you're kind of behind the eight ball, aren't you?
I think that's true. Our contract with the state says that we're supposed to do public awareness activities to get the word out about services and how kids qualify.
That's kind of an interesting requirement for you, Chris Gregory, now that your hours have been cut in
half
of the funding shortage.
Yeah. And so we used to go to doctor's offices and meet with them at lunchtime and talk about how we can make the referral process smooth. We took posters. The posters are no longer, I still have some, but they're kind of disappearing. So the public awareness materials are not as prominent as they once were. I think it's up to the local agencies to get the word out to the doctor's offices and the hospitals, the issue is a lot of times turnover in the hospitals and the doctor's offices. Another humongous issue is that the doctor's offices don't want to meet with us a lot of times unless we can provide them with a lunch. And so that's not in our budget either. Right. So we're kind of at a between a rock and a hard place of how do we get our information over there and make sure that we can adequately explain the different ways a child can qualify and still remain in our budget.
And I just
in terms of spreading the word and following up on Chris Robinson's question, anybody listening to this program who is aware of a child who might qualify, a child who was born premature, a child who was born with a medical condition that obviously needs help, a child who has a developmental delay of some kind, if they want to know how to find out more, do they simply Google the words infant and toddler connection?
They can Google the words infant and toddler connection. They can also go to www.infantva.org. And there's a lot of information for parents and providers and how to make a referral. There is the central directory that has the listing of whatever area you're in Virginia, who you would contact to get into services. There's also our local agency. There's the local agency in Harrisonburg, Waynesboro, and we are both through the community services boards. Augusta County is through Augusta County Public Schools, so that would be how they would get
locally. Lots of information. Let's just emphasize that anywhere in Virginia, if you look up the words infant and toddler connection, you'll get some useful information. Also, it so happens that if you go to WMRA.org and look on the Virginia Insight page, we have web links on that page to the different agencies represented here today, including Infant and Toddler Connection. Brittany Forgrave, parent in Waynesboro, waiting so patiently. Do you have a final thought you want to leave us with?
Well, one quick remark to that whole little conversation that just happened is, I know we can't change the past, but we can change now and change the future. And I know for me, I advocate every time I'm at work or with friends, and I tell people about infant and toddler connection and early intervention. And I think we as the parents that now are receiving it need to help spread the word and spread it out, because that's going to be the strongest, most amazing way to help get the word out there. I mean, I know that there's, you know, all these budget challenges, but we have to be the voice now, and we have to help spread the word. So I just know that for me and for my family and for my son, we would not be where we are right now, and he would not have these successes that he has now without early intervention.
Brittany Forgrave in Waynesboro, mom to newly reached age of two, Jax, as well as Christopher Robinson from Stanton, father to 21-month-old Caitlin. Thank you both so much for taking this time to share your stories with us.
You're welcome.
Thank you.
If you'd like to join us here on Virginia Insight, 888-WMRA-TALK is the easy way to remember our number. We've got just a couple minutes left to take calls. Now, by some estimates, Virginia is more than $8 million short of the money it is required by federal statute to be putting into early childhood intervention and treatment programs. As a result, many families who need such treatments for a child are on long waiting lists. Since those services are supposed to be available, some advocates have likened this to making a child wait outside the schoolhouse door because there's not enough money to let him in. Do you see the situation that way, or as something different? 888-WMRA-TALK by phone. On Facebook, we're listed as WMRA's Virginia Insight. Emily Griffey, from Voices for Virginia's Children, obviously, there are budget troubles in Virginia right now. What are you seeing in terms of the possibility that additional money is going to be coming from the General Assembly to help fund these treatment programs?
Well, it's really a tough budget picture right now at the General Assembly. We are hoping, though, that things like early intervention just rise to the top of the priority list when things pay off in the long term with their investment and can really help kids and family. There's a large need from the constituents that are calling for it. It just has to rise to the top in order to ensure that there is enough funding. We don't like services for kids to be compared or competing with other healthcare services, transportation, education. But we think that there's an important, that there's really things that are really important and can be a priority.
Chris Gregory, this takes us back. Chris Gregory from Infant and Toddler Connection takes us back to the question we started to address earlier about cost benefit. And you're one of those who tries to make the case that situations like the parents that we just heard from, Brittany Forgrave and Chris Robinson, and their children face, that if they had not gotten the treatment that is helping their kids now thrive, that later in life, these children, when they reach age 5, 10, 15, 20, should they live that long, they would actually end up costing taxpayers far more?
That's correct.
Tell me about that.
Well, in Brittany's case, if she hadn't gotten those services early, when Jax was age appropriate to go to school at the age of 3, he would be so far behind on those gains that he'd made. And it's through the investment in early intervention, it's proven that those kids who go on to need services don't need as intensive services as they would have had if they hadn't gotten anything under the age of 3.
And I also just wanted to point out that although there is a state budget shortfall for this, for these services, the federal government also provides funding. A lot of the services are actually reimbursed through insurance or Medicaid if the family has Medicaid. And for some families, they may pay on a sliding scale for services. So the what makes the difference to ensure that we have enough state funding is that there are things like the coordination, the outreach, the billing of all of these multiple entities that can pay for the services.
Do I understand correctly that it's $8.5 million more that you want the General Assembly to put into this fund than is currently there? That it would take, in fact, about $8.5 million more to get up to the minimum that the federal government has set for how this is supposed to be funded?
Well, to serve the current need. The $8.5 million would cover the projected need in the state. Right now, there hasn't been any additional funding for early intervention since Mark Warner's administration.
But didn't the governor, the current governor, McDonnell, actually put in some additional money in his budget proposal for this year?
Yes, there is some funding proposed for this year. And so we
but
need
it falls
to hear
far short of what you say is needed.
Right. And we need to hear from constituents to tell their legislators as they are working on the budget, actually right now in Richmond this week, as they're coming up with their initial recommendations, that early intervention, the funding that the governor has put in and the additional $5.5 million that will fund the shortfall need to be included in that budget and need to be a priority. So if there are parents out there that have stories to share with their legislators, I hope that they will contact them today, this week. They can visit Voices website at vakids.org to find out more information about how to contact their legislators and who are making those decisions in Richmond around the state's budget.
Chris Griffey, what have we not, I'm sorry, Chris Gregory. We got multiple Chris's, we got multiple G names, we've got medical conditions that I mispronounce. Sounds like the usual Virginia Insight hosting on my part, but you've got the important part, Chris Gregory, because we're almost out of time. And I'd like you to either repeat what you think most needs to be repeated or to touch on something that you think is crucial that we have not yet touched on.
Well, I think that we've talked a lot about medical conditions and automatic qualifiers, and just to get the word out there that there's a lot of ways to qualify for these services. You can have a 25% delay in language, a 25% delay in how gross motor, fine motor, all kinds of different ways. There's also atypical development, which may capture those kids that who possibly may be on the autism spectrum. And then there's a whole list of automatic qualifiers. So I think that it's just important to know that it doesn't just have to be a medical need to access these services. Mm-hmm. And that if you have a concern about your child not being where they should be developmentally, you can call and request a screening. And that is free to anyone in Virginia who would like a screening to see if their child is developmentally appropriate.
We had a caller early in the program, Lori from Charlottesville, talking about actually having taken her child off the waiting list in her community because they had waited so long. They, in essence, were giving up on getting mm-hmm. access to this service. There is hope that the General Assembly is going to come up with at least some more money and make those waiting lists shorter. If there's somebody who's on a waiting list right now, what do you want to say to them?
I would probably like to say not to give up. Look in your community for other services that may be available to get you through until maybe you're up higher on the waiting list. Sometimes calling and asking, where am I on the waiting list? Is there anything you can do for me at this moment?
And contacting your legislators
exactly.
and telling your story that this is critical to meet the needs right now so that babies don't have to wait for these services.
Our guests have been Chris Gregory, local system manager for the Early Childhood Treatment Agency Infant and Toddler Connection of Harrisonburg, Rockingham, and the senior policy analyst for the group Voices for Virginia's Children, Emily Griffey. Plus, earlier in the program, Brittany Forgrave, mother to two-year-old son Jax, who's receiving early childhood intervention treatments at the family's home in Waynesboro, as well as Chris Robinson, father to 21-month-old daughter Caitlin, who's receiving similar services at the Robinson Family Home in Stanton, Virginia. Thank you also very much for making time for us.
Thank you. Thank you very much for having us.
You can find audio postings of Virginia Insight by going online to WMRA.org, then clicking on Programs, and then clicking on Virginia Insight. And if you go to that page, you will find links to more information about today's topic. Thank you so very much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.